Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In 2014, Dale Earnhardt Jr. was riding high and riding fast, kicking off the NASCAR season with a victory.
Third-generation star Dale Earnhardt Jr. brings him to the flag. Checkered flag waving. It's over. It's Earnhardt.
Oh, yeah!
That career-defining Daytona 500 win, his second on stock car racing's most hallowed stretch of asphalt, was bookended, however, by two tough moments in his professional life, a series of concussions that curtailed his time on the track.
Fox tracks in on Dale Earnhardt Jr. to show his speed.
He hit that wall at 130 miles an hour. Looking at the windshield, he almost probably didn't even see what was fixing to happen there. It happened so fast.
Well, this hour on Point, Dale Earnhardt Jr. opens up about concussions, about fears, and why he put an end to his storied career. Now, you can join us. We've all heard of the dangers of brain trauma in football or hockey, sports we've played since childhood. But what about motorsports? What's your question for Dale Earnhardt Jr. and about all the hits he's taken and his fellow drivers are taking perhaps every day on the NASCAR circuit? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Dale Earnhardt Jr. joins us now from New York. He's a third-generation NASCAR driver, son to the legendary Dale Earnhardt Sr. He's also a 15-time winner. 15-time winner of NASCAR's Most Popular Driver Award and a 2-time winner of the Daytona 500. His new book out today is titled Racing to the Finish, My Story. Dale Earnhardt Jr., welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It's really great to have you. Now listen, I devoured your book yesterday, and it's truly awesome. No, I mean, you put us both inside the car in a way that, I mean, only you and your fellow drivers have experienced, and also inside your head. And so, I mean, I just want to talk about that. Can we start by hearing you tell us the story of one of the ugliest crashes that you took, but it's one that people haven't seen because it was August 2012 at Kansas Speedway, but it was during a tire test. But it's a pretty critical moment in your career. Can you tell us about what happened then?
Yeah, sure. You know, most of the crashes that you're going to see on TV or see a race car driver take are not going to be extremely dangerous to their health. And there's a lot of precautions and things learned over the years to make the cars really safe. And I always felt that way when I was driving a car, that I was in an extremely safe environment and away from harm. But on this particular day, we were racing. We had a car that was really fast, and we were at a track that had been recently repaved. So it provided excellent grip and excellent speed and very smooth surface. And we were running speeds entering the corner over 200 miles an hour. And I was on a 20-lap run, and the purpose of this test, aside from getting information for ourselves, was to determine the tire that would best suit the racetrack and for the upcoming race, to help the tire manufacturer make a good decision on that.
Yeah.
And I was running a 20-lap run and was on the very last lap of that run. And I was going down the front straightaway and at the most at the fastest part of the racetrack right before I entered the first turn, probably running about 205 or 210 miles an hour. As soon as I lifted off the gas and the car, that action of kind of coming off the gas settles the car onto the front tires, that increased that just that slight increase of pressure and load into the tire blew the sidewall out of the tire. Because the 20 laps that I had ran had created a tremendous amount of
heat,
in the tire. So we, when it blew the tire out, there's no control of the car at that point. It's just going to go straight. And I went into the wall at about 180 miles an hour at about a 30-degree angle, and I was never knocked unconscious. And that's one thing that's unique about, I think my story is that when I know a lot of drivers who have had crashes where they have been knocked out, and we've seen video of it. And,
yeah.
and I never had a crash that knocked me unconscious, and you don't have to be knocked unconscious to have a head injury. And I knew right away that that was going to be an extremely scary experience. As the car's heading toward the wall, there's only like a couple seconds there between when the you hear the tire and you realize you've lost control and you know you're going to hit this wall. And it's very scary, but it seems to slow down to where you get to think about it for a few seconds. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm just going to be real lucky if I survive this uninjured. And the car hits the wall and rode against the wall for about 300, 400 yards before it finally came to a stop, and I climbed out of the car. And another driver that was there testing as well heard the crash from the garage area. His name is Brad Kozlowski, and he said it sounded like an airplane crash.
Yeah.
And he jumped in his rental car and drove over there to get me and took me back to the garage where I would meet up with my team.
Well, Dale, can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah.
Because yesterday when I was reading this part of the book, I was in our office and I was reading it, and I hit this particular section that you're talking about, and I literally yelped out loud, "Oh my goodness!" Because you write how you hit the wall. And the amount of force on your body, in your head, because the car, you know, it has all these components to record, the black boxes to record what's happening to the car. You hit the wall at 40 Gs? I mean, 40 Gs?
Yeah, it was at 40 Gs. And that's, you know, that's obviously an extreme amount of force. And our cars, our heads are cocooned sort of in this headrest of hard foam. That's part of the seat, and it's to protect your, you know, head from flying violently around in the car. If you do have a crash like that, your head and your neck can stretch and do some real damage to your neck and your spinal cord. And but you know, we've created this kind of scenario with these headrests to prevent basal skull fractures and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So. Along with the Hans device and other things that are involved in the safety of the car. Your head hits this – your head's against the headrest at you know, before impact. You're in there like very tight. Your helmet's very tight in there. And so when it hits the – when you hit a wall, your helmet doesn't go anywhere. Your head really doesn't go anywhere. And what's inside your head is what moves.
Right.
And so
well,
it
so,
was
– I mean, like how did it – so obviously, I mean, that was a huge hit, and afterwards, though, like, how did you feel?
Well, I didn't notice anything right away. I mean, I was sort of maybe a little scared and a bit in shock for a few seconds immediately after the crash, but I was happy that I was awake and happy that it seemed like everything was in one piece. I didn't feel anything until I got down into the garage about 5 or 10 minutes after the crash, and I was talking to one of my team members, one of my mechanics, and he said, you know, you don't look right. He's like, you're looking through me. You look glassy-eyed and dazed, and you can tell me you feel okay, but I don't think you are. And I wasn't, and I knew what he meant, and there was really no way to hide it. It just feels like shell shock or some sort, you know, you're just kind of in a daze and it's a fog and it's a hangover, if you will, that you can't get rid of, you can't shake. And then
here's the thing though, that's one of the recurring themes in the book. You have this hit where you know because of a blown tire you hit a wall at 180 miles an hour. It's obviously had an effect, but you showed up and raced that weekend anyway.
Yeah, so
and that's the culture of NASCAR, right? Drivers don't get out of their cars.
Yeah, the knowledge that we had at the time was that you just waited on those type of, you know, issues to go away. You didn't go to a doctor. You didn't go to a specialist for sure. And there was no knowledge for me or anyone else that I needed to see help in that moment. And had I had that knowledge, I might have made some different decisions. But, you know, there, at that moment and that time and even, you know, many, many years before that, there was just ignorance over how to handle that type of situation and especially personally how to handle that type of situation. So, I mean, which I've learned a tremendous amount ever since. And
the recurring phrase in the book is put a washcloth on it.
Yeah. So
I don't mean to smile, but it's like it just keeps coming up over and over again. You talk about like that's how whenever we're talking about a 2012 impact you had. And obviously you'd had hundreds of races before that where things got tough. And every time you're like, I just put a washcloth on it.
Yeah. When I was I wrecked in 1998 at Daytona and had a concussion, and my dad won the race, the Daytona 500, the biggest race of his career, the following day. And I was at home on the couch with a concussion with a rag on my head, because a rag on my forehead was the only thing that would make me feel better. And that, so we kind of use that analogy for the rest of the book as I started, you know, as I continued to get these kind of injuries and continued to work, you know, just kind of walk through it and race the next day or the next week, the next weekend without any issue.
Yeah. I mean, you write about in the book how the history of NASCAR is drivers who race, you know, pretty much to the limit of their physical endurance, with broken bones, with taped up eyelids because their faces were so swollen from previous crashes, that there's this like toughness that you just don't get out of the car, which is maybe one thing that until, I don't know, relatively recently that made drivers not talk all that much about the invisible injuries that came from concussions.
Yeah, the issues for me really were about I got scared straight. You know, I got scared into going to the doctor, and it wasn't about waking up one day and going, man, I need to make a right choice here. I need to make a better decision, or I need to be more informed. I was just frightened for what was happening in my head and what was happening to me.
Well, we will talk more about that when we come back. You're listening to Dale Earnhardt Jr. His new book is Racing to the Finish, My Story. What's your question for one of NASCAR's most storied drivers? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dale Earnhardt Jr. He is a retired NASCAR driver, one of the most popular drivers in NASCAR history, two-time winner of the Daytona 500. He retired with 26 wins in the NASCAR Cup Series. And he's the author of a new book. It's titled Racing to the Finish, My Story. And it's the story of all the concussions he suffered as a NASCAR driver, what effect they had on his life, and what he did to heal himself, and why he's speaking out about concussions and NASCAR as well. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Now, Dale, before the break, we were talking about that really hard hit that you took on the tire test in 2012 in Kansas. And I want to play a little bit of sound of a very significant race that happened not long after that at Talladega. This is kind of the bookends of the big hits that you took that scared you straight, as you were saying a little bit earlier. So first of all, let's listen to what happened in the last last lap of the Good Sam Roadside Assistance 400 at the Talladega Super Speedway in Alabama. There was a huge pack of cars there in that last lap, and here's what happened.
Oh, there's contact!
Get out of you now.
Stewart into the middle of the pack and over!
Watch it now.
Huge wreck to end this race.
In that last lap, the cars are basically four deep there, going at 200 miles an hour. If you haven't seen it or you don't remember it, it's on YouTube, and it is breathtaking to watch. Now, here's Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s over-the-radio conversation with his crew chief, Steve Letart, right after, just moments after, that Talladega crash.
You okay, buddy?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's like that I could take.
Well, so Dale, tell us about that moment, because I think it was after that and how you felt after that. That's what took you to go get help.
Yeah. So this was 4 weeks after the Kansas crash that had been so terrible for me. And I had been suffering with the symptoms for those 4 weeks, and I had finally started to feel like my old self again coming into Talladega that weekend. So there was a big, big sense of relief for me. But there was also a sense of fear, because at Talladega they have these big packs of cars, and when there are those type of crashes, they're impossible to escape. So I knew the chances of me being involved in another accident were very high for that particular weekend. So I was very nervous about that. All I wanted was just to be able to get through that race clean with no problems, and I felt like I'd be home free. And I got involved in that crash, and during that crash, a car T-boned the side of the car and spun the car around, and I immediately went all the way back to having the symptoms that I had before, and maybe even worse. And so,
but this was a different kind of injury, though, right? Because
yeah,
you were like whipped around.
Yeah. So this was, instead of an impact, you know, a direct impact, this was a very quick, fast spin. And so I knew immediately something was wrong with me again, and I was really angry about it and very emotional, unusually emotional for some reason. And you can hear that in the radio communication, and that's something I typically probably wouldn't be having. I wouldn't be really having that personal of a conversation over that radio, because
yeah,
it's something that the entire team and all the fans can hear and have access to. But in those moments when you're injured and you're not really in control of your emotions and your anxieties and all those things. And so I knew that through reading about concussions and hearing these stories. So over the past 5 years, you know, there's just been so much coverage of concussions, whether it's NFL players or what have you, retired players. There's just so much content out there, so many stories. And I can't I couldn't help myself from sort of absorbing some of that. And it frightened me, you know. So when I was – and I'd learned and read about layering concussions together and having concussions very close together in a very short period of time. And
right.
So here I am, and I'm thinking, man, I'm really playing with fire. I better take this seriously. This could be something – you know, these issues could become permanent. That would be awful, to have to wake up every day with something changed about you and something you couldn't correct.
Well, Dale, can I just jump in here for a second?
Sure.
Because, you know, you write about in the book about how right after that crash, that second hit at Talladega, as you were saying, like, you were more emotional, less restrained. I mean, NASCAR drivers have to be amongst the most emotionally controlled people in the world, right? When you're whirling around a track at 200 miles an hour. But you say in the book that now I was just angry all the time, that you drove your wrecked car back to the garage and ESPN had a TV camera there waiting on me, big pack of reporters wanting to ask you about the crash. So you started talking and your eyes get wide and your volume picks up and your face starts turning red. And here's what you said.
I can't believe that nobody's sensible enough to realize just how ridiculous that was. I mean, that is ridiculous. If this was what we did every week, I wouldn't be doing it. I'll just put it to you like that.
Yeah.
If this is how we raced every week, I'd find another job. It's bloodthirsty if that's the way people, if that's what people want. I mean, it's ridiculous. I don't even want to go to Daytona or Talladega next year, but I ain't got much choice. It's really not racing. I don't know. It's just it's a little disappointing how that all went down. That was ridiculous. It was like, cost a lot of money right there. It's just a lot of wasted. I mean, if this is how we're going to race and that's how we're going to continue to race and nothing's going to change, I think NASCAR ought to build the cars. Save us a lot of money.
Dale Earnhardt Jr., how out of character was that for you?
I think it's pretty out of character, yeah. To be that aggressive, I think, was out of character for me. And I could feel my emotions in that moment, you know, sort of not I could feel myself not being able to shut up, you know, not being able to bite my lip and keep those opinions to myself because they were going to do me no good by sharing them in that environment. And I did get some pushback from NASCAR about those comments, particularly the bloodthirsty comment. And they weren't very happy with me. And I know better than that. You know, I know NASCAR well enough, and my intentions in my career have been to try to lift the sport up and be a great representative for the sport. And in that moment, I was not doing that, and I couldn't control it. That was the worst part about it. And I could not control my emotions and with that injury having just occurred. And I dealt with that for the next, you know, 48 hours trying to calm down, trying to make sense of what I was feeling, trying to figure out what I was going to do about it. And luckily, I got pointed in the right direction to see a specialist, a neurosurgeon that was local in Charlotte, Dr. Petty.
Yeah.
And so that man, that right there was the saving grace for me, because I don't know whether I would have made the right decisions going forward to take care of myself had I not been put in front of the right people.
Yeah. So we got a lot of callers who want to talk to you, and I want to get to them.
Great.
In just a second here. But let me ask you, I mean, the way you write about the kind of hits that you took, we were talking about two big ones there, but also there's a lot of, and I'm putting smaller in quotes here, because in NASCAR, nothing's really small, but, you know, because everything's going so fast. I just wonder, like, how many of your fellow drivers have had concussions? How often do you think drivers are behind the wheel, you know, in these races with their, you know, not at 100% because of the effects of getting hit in the head all the time?
I think it's very rare. I actually do.
Okay.
I feel like that crash in 2012 was an anomaly for me. I feel like that it was a, you know, just a unique style of accident and impact that not a lot of drivers will experience in their career. For the majority of my career, I never was having problems with a crash that would be 15 to 25 G's. And that's a standard sort of impact for most crashes. Whenever you make contact with something, it's anywhere from 15 to 25 G's. And most drivers will have them multiple times throughout a season, throughout a career, and never think about it, never get out and go, there's something wrong with me. No, never, it's nothing. So,
well, but NASCAR, on the other hand, though, has made a lot of changes in terms of how the tests that it wants drivers to do on the infield, and they've pretty significantly increased their concussion screening.
Absolutely, yeah. They've made some great choices to sort of help the drivers protect themselves. It's really about saving the drivers from themselves, trying to educate the drivers, trying to educate people on how to make the better decision in those situations. And I think NASCAR is doing a great job with the information they have and what they'll continue to get, what they'll continue to learn. We're all learning now through this process over the last 5 or 10 years, what's happened and what's been learned and taught, understood about concussions and treatment is incredible. And NASCAR's evolution of their protocol in the past 3 years has been tremendous, and it will continue to be. So my book's really about, I hope it educates some people in NASCAR. That'd be great if the industry was reading it and learning from it. But it's more about really trying to help that athlete that I was, or maybe that person on the job that doesn't know quite what to do with this injury, and point them in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking this hour with Dale Earnhardt Jr., His new book is Racing to the Finish, My Story. In a couple minutes, we're going to hear from a doctor who is really instrumental in helping you heal from your head injuries, Dale. But I got to let some of these callers in because we've got folks who want to talk to you. So,
sounds great.
So let's go to Tim, who's calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. Tim, you're on the air with Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Hey, Junior. How's it going?
It's going good, man.
It's an honor to talk to you. I just want to say congratulations on your marriage.
Thank you.
And, you know, it's awesome that you had the courage to step out and do what you did and, you know, step out of the shadows when you had a concussion. And I know that it was probably tough. My question is, how hard was it to decide to stop racing? And how hard is it to go back to the racetrack every weekend and commentate?
That's a great question.
Yeah, not race. Tim, thanks so much.
Yeah, so I've taken a job as a commentator in the sport, so it keeps me at the racetrack, and so I've been going over the last several months as a broadcaster, and the decision to get out of the car was a real easy one for me personally because I had experienced so much with the concussion problems, and I knew that I was playing with fire and more than likely not going to continue to be able to be injury free if I raced. I knew, or I felt pretty confident that if I raced again, I would be back in Pittsburgh visiting my doctor, Mickey Collins, trying to get more help, and he would be going, "Why are you doing this?" So I felt like I needed to make that decision, make it final, and I felt great about it ever since I've made it. Going back to the racetrack as a broadcaster, I've been going to a racetrack every weekend pretty much since I was a little boy, and when I retired from driving, I wasn't going to just go home and never go back. I couldn't do that. I'm just so used to being at the track, and I love it, and I'm a fan of the sport. So this opportunity as a broadcaster gives me that chance to be at the track and still be a part of the sport's future and health. And I think the broadcaster plays an important role in the weekend, and so I'm loving that opportunity to be a part of the sport. And I do miss a lot about driving. I miss parts of it. I see things the drivers are doing or going through mm-hmm. that make me wish I was out there at times, but I feel great about the decision I made.
Yeah. Let's go to Derek, who's calling from Bangor, Maine. You're on the air, Derek.
Hi, Magna. Hi, Dale.
Hey.
I had a quick question. I didn't know if perhaps throughout the years you may have noticed some of these same issues you mentioned in the garage when your friend saw you were looking past him. Maybe you had seen the same things in your father after some incidents of his, especially where safety equipment wasn't up to the par that it is today.
Yeah. Derek, thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question, too. I don't think I ever saw that in my dad. You know, he was, I know about a lot of injuries that he hid. He had had a cracked vertebrae and raced through that and several injuries that he had tried to continue to race through, but I never noticed or never realized any kind of accident where I was worried about him from a brain injury standpoint. He did have a spell at Darlington one race where one morning he got in the car and had to get out of the car immediately before the race even started, and he was very delirious and didn't know what was going on and where he was and what he was doing, and they could not, they did a million tests on him and couldn't figure out what had created that and what had caused that, but it'd be interesting if he were here today. He mm-hmm. passed away in 2001. It'd be interesting if he were here today what he would say about what I've went through and what information he may have about his own career that would be interesting to me about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as folks know, as your dad did die on the track at the Daytona 500 in 2001. And that was a huge moment for NASCAR, right? He was killed instantly when his car hit the wall at, I don't know, was it 180, something like that, miles an hour. And a lot of the safety changes in the cars came after that. And so do you think, I mean, as you write about in the book, there were even more safety changes that came after people started paying more attention, in part because of you talking about it, about concussions. I mean, how safe can it get? I mean, it's never going to be 100% safe, right?
No, yeah. I mean, it's you're racing cars at a very fast speed. It's always going to have some sort of danger, element of danger, and I think that that's sort of what makes it so interesting is that element of danger and that it's unique, that only certain people are good at it and willing to do it. And I am, you know, of course, there were tons of advances in safety when my father passed away, and I hope. I hope that we continue to learn more. I would love for this, the technology in the interior of the car, as far as the driver's headrests and seats and so forth, to continue to improve and help people, be able to prevent the types of things that happened to me. And I'm sure that's always going to be happening. If you look at the cars and the cockpit of the cars from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, I mean, they've changed tremendously since then.
Well, we're speaking with Dale Earnhardt Jr. He is a retired professional NASCAR driver, a 15-time winner of NASCAR's Most Popular Driver Award, double winner of the Daytona 500. His new book is called Racing to the Finish, My Story. And when we come back, we're going to hear from Dr. Michael Mickey Collins, the doctor who helped Dale Earnhardt Jr. heal from his multiple concussions. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dale Earnhardt Jr. His new book is Racing to the Finish, My Story. And it's about all the concussions he suffered as a top-tier NASCAR driver. He's a 2-time winner of the Daytona 500, 15-time winner of NASCAR's Most Popular Driver Award. And earlier in the hour, we talked in detail about two concussions that he suffered in 2012. But those were not his first. I mean, in the book, Dale Earnhardt Jr. writes about how in 1998, for example, his car rolled in a race and his head hit the roll cage so hard that his helmet had put a big dent into the bar. That was a 1998 crash. And then in 2002, April 28th, he crashed during the Napa Auto Parts 500 at the California Speedway in Fontana, California.
See, he's awake, alert, talking to the rescue personnel.
I just knocked a breath out of him, I guess. I tell you, they've done such a great job with the inside of these cars and the head and neck restraint systems and everything else. I think he's got the breath knocked out of him. Plus, I hope that's all it is.
Yeah, definitely. That long pause, that's what everyone hoped it all it was. But shortly before the September 2002 Protection 1 400 in Kansas City, so several months after that Fontana crash, Earnhardt Jr. was interviewed about the concussion he had in California.
I made my own decision, and I felt like staying in the car was the only thing that really could help me decide exactly how bad the situation was and how long I needed to get better. So I know better next time. I shouldn't have kept it a secret as much as I did, but, I didn't want to cause too much alarm because it really wasn't as serious, I guess, as everybody has made it out to be.
That's Dale Earnhardt Jr. back in 2002. Well, joining us now is Michael Mickey Collins. He's the director of the University of Pittsburgh's Medical Center Sports Medicine Concussion Program, and he started treating Dale Earnhardt Jr. for concussions in 2012. He also wrote the foreword for Racing to the Finish, the new book. Michael Mickey Collins, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
It's really great to have you because obviously, as Dale writes in the book, you're a real key figure in his healing from the multiple concussions he suffered. When he first came into your office, I mean, you've treated thousands of folks and professional athletes. I mean, what did you see when this NASCAR driver came to you?
Well, I've seen him. I saw Dale twice, 2012 and 2016. And on both occasions, you know, the first time I saw Dale, we actually got Dale better pretty quickly from that. And he did very well with our therapies. The second time I saw Dale, he was very sick with these issues that we commonly see with concussion. And quite honestly, I didn't care as much about Dale becoming a race car driver again. I wanted Dale to become a human that felt normal.
Right.
And that was the first precedent for everything. And
can I just jump in here, though? Because, I mean, the sickness that he was suffering, he writes about so clearly in the book. There was vision problems, balance problems, essentially all the things, hand-eye coordination, all the things that you need to be in control of a vehicle moving at 200 miles an hour.
Or to be in control of life.
Of life. Yeah.
So racing really wasn't, it wasn't even on the radar initially when we saw Dale. And you know, we've really identified, we've learned a lot about concussion, and there's so much we've learned now in terms of identifying where the aberrant signal is coming from and then matching the right treatment to the right problem. And we were able to do that with Dale and kind of pinpoint what the problems were and set him on a course of rehab that that eventually got him better. And Dale is doing great now, and it's really nice to see.
Yeah. So, but Mickey Collins, I think one thing that surprised me about what Dale wrote in the book is that you prescribed both times this very, very specific regimen of exercises and a protocol essentially that would push his brain to the limit of what it could tolerate at that time. Because I was under the impression that perhaps this is now very much out of date, but the thought was that you should reduce cognitive load when a brain is healing from concussions.
I think that's a common perception or misperception, really, of how we approach concussion treatment. We've actually identified now that there's six different types of concussions, and there's some types of concussions where, quote-unquote, rest, or at least regulated rest, it may be indicated. But in Dale's profile of difficulties, the way you treat the problems that Dale had is actually through rehabilitation or retraining. And so it depends on what type of concussion you have as to how we approach it, whether it's a more active-based approach, whether it's regulation or whatnot. But you need to go to a clinician that can identify, again, where is the aberrant signal coming from and then match the right treatment to the right problem. That's what concussion is becoming. And it's very exciting because this is not a homogenous event. It's a very heterogeneic event. If there's 30 different types of knee injuries, why do we think there's one type of concussion?
Yeah. Well, Dale Earnhardt Jr., in the book, you write that the second time that you sought treatment from Mickey Collins, that you didn't actually get all that many phone calls from drivers, because that's just not necessarily what driver culture is like. But you did hear from some drivers who had either previously suffered from concussion or hadn't really reached out for help.
Yeah, actually, that was so interesting, I guess. Hearing from retired drivers or even drivers that had just recently had suffered a concussion that were looking for some direction and some advice and looking just really just to be able to contact Mickey, how to get to Pittsburgh where he was and see him. That was, I think, the beginning of the reason for writing this book. And Mickey has told me time and time again, whether it's an article someone's read or he's read or whether it's, you know, whatever it is, he's like, you're helping people, you're pushing people to do the right thing, you're directing people to us, you're making a difference here. And he'll tell you that he has people that come in every week that connect their visit to the hospital to something they read or saw me talk about.
Yeah.
And that encouragement from Mickey to continue to talk, continue to be honest, continue to be open and transparent has resulted in this book.
Yeah.
And, so that I love helping people, especially when you can follow along with their progress or if it's, you know, I've made friends by meeting strangers and directing them to Mickey and continuing to support them and continuing to, you know, encourage mm-hmm. them through the process. And I've made some pretty good friends through that.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but there's a moment that you write about after your first meeting with Mickey Collins that you said was possibly one of the most important things that he said to you, that you were so concerned, freaked out really, about how much you were struggling after your dual concussions in 2012, but that he told you that it could be fixed. Now, why was that so profound for you?
That, you know, he did that on a couple of occasions. Yeah. I'll talk about this one in particular. I had my eyes were not working, not focusing, they weren't stable. If I walked across the room, the environment shook, and my eyes just wouldn't settle, and it was so frustrating. Because it was there every minute of every day, and it affected anything and everything you did. And it was there for months. It wasn't getting better. I was working and rehabbing and doing the exercises and the homework that Mickey had given me, and it wasn't changing. And I was getting more and more worried. And so I called Mickey, and I said, Mickey, I really just got to ask you something real quick. And I said, have you seen this eye problem? And because a patient's idea is that the doctor has to stay positive. He's not going to be a negative person and tell you this isn't going to work and this is what you got to do. You know, he's going to be positive because he believes that he can fix it. And I wanted to know for sure, hey, Mickey, have you seen this eye problem, this exact thing? Have you heard someone explain it exactly like I'm explaining it? Yeah, I have. And have you fixed it? He says, yes, hundreds and hundreds of times I've fixed this, and I just needed to know that so I would keep working, quit worrying. The worst fear that you have as a concussion patient with symptoms is that they're there forever,
yeah.
That they're permanent. That's such a scary, scary thing, and they're not, you know, and that's what I think we need to share with people is that if they can get in front of Mickey and his staff, that they can fix these issues.
Well, so Mickey Collins, talk to us about that, because I mean, it must be really terrifying to think that all these basic functions of how you live are gone and out of your control. That's the other thing that Dale talks about in the book, that he just felt so out of control. So what allowed you to have the confidence to tell him, like, we can fix these things?
I firmly believe this is a treatable injury, and we see patients, we see a lot of patients, you know, about 18,000 patient visits a year to our program, and we see, as Dale said, we see these issues, and we've developed physical therapies that can treat the issues. And in being a clinician, it's my job to figure out why is this occurring, what's the right treatment, what's the right approach we have to take, and Dale calling me and alerting me to that and telling me he was frustrated, it allowed me to understand what was going on and then prescribe the right program. Concussion is a lot of misinformation out there about this injury. We've really learned a tremendous amount. I would actually state that it's never been safer to have a concussion because there's been so many advances in terms of how we approach this injury from a treatment standpoint. And we can get patients better. We can get patients feeling normal again. And I felt very confident with Dale, even though he was very sick. It's a very disconcerting thing to go through as a patient, but, you know, real advances have occurred here.
Yeah. Well, let's see if I can squeeze a couple of calls in here before we run out of time. Steven's calling from Charlottesville, West Virginia. Oh, sorry. Excuse me, Steve. Steven's calling from Charleston, West Virginia. I'm going to get that right, Steven. Sorry about that, but you're on the air now.
Oh, that's no problem. Everybody gets that wrong.
No, I should get it right. I just can't speak straight sometimes.
No problem. Just want to say, hey, everyone. Dale had a couple quick questions. First one is, have you rewatched any of the races and maybe kind of like wondered what you could have done differently if you felt like it was your fault, or are they just, you know, too painful to relive? And then the second half of that, given what you've gone through and experienced, what would your reaction be if little old Isla one day said she wanted to be a race car driver?
Well, Stephen, thank you for your call. Dale, go ahead.
Yeah, those are good questions. Thank you, Stephen. I've watched the races again and watched the crashes again for sure. And it doesn't really bother me to see them. I can't help myself to wonder what if they had not happened or if a particular crash had not happened. I think about that 2012 tire test at Kansas all the time and think, man, what if one little thing had went differently? What if I had just pulled in a lap sooner? What if we had, you know, this or that and the other different things would have, you know, ended differently and maybe that would not have happened at all.
Well, you can't torture yourself like that. Though,
I know,
right?
Yeah.
The past is the past.
It's human nature, I believe, to just, you know, have those type of thoughts. As far as if my daughter or really anyone wants to become a race car driver, I would certainly, if she, you know, I'm going to want to be involved and encourage and be a part of anything she's interested in. I would never not encourage someone to be a race car driver, football player, anything they wanted to do, and just have the information that I have going forward so that if you find yourself in a difficult situation with a head injury or a concussion, you make the right choice.
Right.
I didn't make the right choice many, many times. I made the wrong choice over and over, and it got me in big trouble. And I, you know, I would still be racing today had I made better choices. That's a message I think that that people need to know.
We've got time for one more caller at least here. Let's go to John, who's calling from Mooresville, North Carolina. You're on the air, John.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. How you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Dale just answered my question. I was just going to say, had he not had these severe concussions, but he knows what he knows about them today, and with being married and having Isla and not having any injuries at all, would he still be racing today? But he just answered that.
Okay. All right, John, thank you so much for your call. Mickey Collins, since you're still with us and really grateful to have you today, I mean, what's your message for folks listening? I mean, Dale Earnhardt Jr. obviously has this huge platform to speak out to people to get them to pay attention to concussions. But, I mean, for folks who are on the sports field of any kind or at work, because there's a lot of work-related injuries, I mean, how do you know when to go seek medical help?
Yeah, I mean, there's between 1.8 to 3.6 million concussions occurring per year in this country in sports and recreation alone. So it's a very common occurrence. And I do feel there's a lot of misinformation out there about this injury. It's a treatable problem the great, great, great majority of the time. We can get kids back to the sports they love the great, great, great majority of the time. And there are really active approaches to treatment and rehabilitation. Dale was one of the hardest working patients I've ever met. He so badly wanted to get better from this, and he worked so hard to get there. And I just can't tell Dale how much I appreciate him doing this book and speaking out about this injury, because I do feel there's a lot of people out there going through this that aren't aware that there are treatments available.
Yeah.
And so I really think that messaging that Dale is doing here is really what I want to echo and reinforce, is that get to a clinician, get to a specialist that can treat this injury, and this is happening a lot, and there's help out there.
Well, Dale Earnhardt Jr., we've got about 30 seconds left here, and we've got one question on our website, which I wasn't quite sure how to ask you, but I'll do it anyway, because some folks are wondering if maybe you have plans to donate your brain to the concussion research.
Yeah, absolutely. I already have filled out application and got my card to donate. So it's up to my family once they take possession of my body, whether that actually happens. But that's my intent. I feel like that, you know, whatever can be learned from that would, and if it's beneficial to save people, that I would love to do it. Ever since I met Mickey and got help and assistance, my mission's been to try to help others and avoid the mistakes that I've made, and want to be able to continue to do that long after I'm gone.
Well, I have to say, I think this book goes a long way to fulfilling that goal. It's truly terrific. Dale Earnhardt Jr., author of Racing to the Finish, My Story, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Michael Mickey Collins, director of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center Sports Medicine Concussion Program, thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.